Good morning once again. Welcome to The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and I'm your host for the next 2 hours. We have a really intriguing show tonight because it's about consciousness and consciousness technology. A name or a title or an appellation I just kind of made up, I guess. Before we get to that, I want to make a couple of remarks about the Pope's visit. If you have been following what we did yesterday morning when I talked with, actually the day before yesterday, when I talked with Georgia Lambert, we tried to set the scene for the Pope entering this remarkable set of structures known as Washington, D.C., at twice 19.5 at 39 degrees, filled with all kinds of sacred geometry, which from our measurements does stuff. And it affects consciousness. And again, we will be talking about that later this evening because we've got data. The interesting thing is, as the news folks have been following the Pope around, and he, you know, met with the president this morning at the White House, and there are remarks by both the president and the Pope up at the top of the othersideofmidnight.com page. If you go to othersideofmidnight.com and you click on tonight's guest, that will take you to the guest page. And at the top, under Radio with Pictures, we have remarks by the president and the Pope. And I'd like everyone to just kind of peruse the transcripts because there are little nuggets buried in both speeches that I find intriguing, and I thought I would make it an exercise tonight for you to find, and then you can send me an email as to what you think is significant. Now, the biggie, of course, is tomorrow. At about 10 o'clock Eastern Time tomorrow morning, the Pope is going to, for the first time ever in the history of the papacy and in the history of the United States, a pope is going to deliver an actual address to both sessions of Congress simultaneously, a joint session, and we have no idea what he's going to say. But based on the conversation I had with Georgia Lambert on Tuesday morning, I think it's going to be really interesting and very important for us to focus on what he says, because remember, the model is that he's saying these things and coming to this place because it has, in the torsion field, it has extraordinary power and potential. And he knows consciously that this is what's going on, and he is going to be using it at full volume, at full whatever you want to call it, tomorrow morning. Actually, later this morning. Now, how do we know this? Well, I know it a couple of ways. One is, when we were watching the coverage of his arrival in Washington, I was struck by Brian Williams making a big deal of announcing that the Pope's wheels touched down in the aircraft that he flew in on at 3:50 in the afternoon Washington time. Well, if you kind of look at the globe, that's 19.5 Greenwich Mean Time, and I told someone this evening that, and they were quite taken aback. That, to me, of course, there's no way that can be accidental. That means the Pope and his contingent know exactly what they're doing, as Georgia and I speculated freely on Tuesday morning. And furthermore, as part of the news coverage, there was one network which actually got a camera behind him, and some of the people who had come to see him at the rope line, at the fence. And he very specifically says to one man in particular, "Pray for me. Please remember to pray for me. I need you. Pray for me." Now, what is prayer? Prayer is focused, conscious intention. The Pope is standing in the middle of the most extraordinary structured temple to focus that energy, that intention, to do whatever it is he's here to do, to accomplish. And he basically was asking for help in carrying out that mission. Consciousness as a technology. Which segues tonight into my guest. So let me read what Philip provided, and then we'll segue into our live conversation, because I think this is a very interesting way to present how you move from where you were to where you are in terms of these deeper questions. From a young age, I, as Philip says, had a deep conviction that something was not right with the world. There is one world, one sky, one earth. Why is then there not one principle that unites people in a common worldview? Why can't there be one truth? In a college dorm room in 1973, while taking a class entitled Men in Perspective, I had a thought, Phillips says, that seemed to offer a way to unite the fields of religion, philosophy, and science. The insight was neither entirely new nor original. The main question was, why had it gone unspoken for so long? The answer seemed to be that the new approach contradicted the accepted modern materialistic worldview and made religion look inside for spiritual truths rather than in the afterlife or in the mysterious heaven beyond the senses. It also required the minds of a lot of people deeply set in their ways changing. This was not going to be easy. The new thought went unspoken because no one wanted to give to dive into the tidal wave of the conventional scientific worldview and be declared a heretic, or in our modern world, worse, insane. But this new worldview, continues Philip, made too much sense to let conventional wisdom stand in the way of exploring it further. The worldview has a simple premise. Instead of the universe being created in a big bang, it instead sprang from a united mind that some call God. But since we have only minds known to exist, the united mind of humankind must be the mind of God. This is the same principle advanced for thousands of years both in Eastern philosophy and by the Western idealist philosophers. What happened to it? Well, armed with this simple thought and the conviction that even if wrong, it deserved further examination, I set out to write a paper arguing in favor of the New World Outlook. According to the scientific method, if the theory was right, it would withstand whatever criticism was levied against it, and if wrong, it would fade away like other misguided hypotheses. I wrote, Philip goes on, I wrote the first draft of the book in 1974, rewrote it that summer, took a year to try again, and then concluded I had a lot more to learn. I went on to obtain a degree in philosophy, went to law school, wound up practicing law for 25 years, all the while working on the book. The current version is the 1974 college paper, many rewrites later. I hope you find it interesting. Signed, Philip Camilla, and Philip is with us, and good morning. Welcome to the other side of midnight.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, Richard. It's really enjoyable spending our mornings together, so thank you very much.
Well, we do this at an auspicious time. We have a pope running around Washington for the first time who is doing some very intriguing things and setting up a very interesting political premise that consciousness can actually change mindsets and people's political perspectives and actually perhaps accomplish something. So I guess my first question is, how did you wind up turning from law? You went to Georgetown, I believe. How did you wind up turning from law to something which is a lot less provable?
Well, first of all, I think that Hume, David Hume said, you know, amongst all your philosophizing, be still a man. So I tell people that I'm a man first, philosopher second, a lawyer third. So my scientific / philosophical beliefs come first. I think it's interesting that law itself is based upon logic and evidence, and that's the same basis of science. Science says prove it, and scientific theories are supposed to be rigorous. And so I think that ultimately a scientific theory needs to be provable, just like a legal argument has to be provable.
Yeah, but do philosophical ideas and theories have to be, or can they be provable?
Well, I think that ultimately a philosophical theory is the basis of a scientific worldview. For example, our current scientific worldview is based upon the philosophy of materialism.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question there is, well, is materialism provable?
How do you define materialism?
Materialism is the belief that the world ultimately consists of particles in motion, that particles are the source of creation, that consciousness arose from particles, and that there is no purpose morality in the world because particles themselves are impersonal. without any guidance, without any structure or endpoint. And so materialism is basically the principle that all we are particles in motion, no purpose, direction in the world.
So how do you explain fields in this philosophy? I mean, we have invisible electromagnetic fields, electrostatic fields, gravitational fields. We have weak forces, strong forces. There's a whole panoply of invisible things in operation beyond particles that make up the kind of standard model of reality. How do you handle that?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think science calls fields that the spiritualists would call mind fields. Or, I mean, I think the quantum field, for example, is the same thing that I would call the spiritual field or the dreamscape. So I think it's a matter of looking at things in different perspectives. The difference with modern science is that they separate the fields from themselves. See, I think consciousness is at the root of reality.
Well, no, wait. Quantum mechanics has as its fundamental Copenhagen interpretation, derived from Niels Bohr and the bunch of guys that hung out in Copenhagen, you know, decades and decades and decades ago, at the beginning of the 20th century, basically that observation affects the outcome. In other words, without an observer, reality in their model doesn't exist. So there's an inseparable connection between us, identity, consciousness, and the reality around us at the base of quantum mechanics.
Right. And I would agree. Right. And I think that that's a sign of the connection between consciousness and reality. Right.
Okay.
I would agree with that.
Science is not ignoring the idea of consciousness affecting reality. In fact, it's the heart of the current paradigm that science operates under, certainly physics.
Well, I think that the issue is, to me, Richard, is that science is in a state of internal contradiction. I think that quantum theory, as you point out, shows the unavoidable connection between...
Well, wait. It doesn't show. It asserts. All right, remember, it's interpreting experiments, and they're asserting that there is this quantum consciousness connection. But in fact, when you look at the experiments that they conduct, there's not much data there that supports the idea that consciousness is affecting reality.
Well, I'm not sure if I would agree with that. I think that, and I would agree with your point that we're on the level of interpreting results. I think that is correct, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of different interpretations of quantum theory, and it depends, you know, who you're going to go with. I'm an advocate of those who believe that consciousness is connected to reality, that I think it shows that there's this unbreakable bond. The reason why consciousness affects the two-slit experiment, for example, is because the particles are part of consciousness.
Okay, for the millennials out there who have never taken a science class, please define the two-slit experiment.
Okay, so the two-slit experiment is the famous experiment showing that if you have, I guess, a sheet of metal with two slits in it, and you pass a beam of light or electrons through it, then depending upon whether you're trying to determine if the electron is a wave or a particle, depending upon what you choose to look for, you will find either the electron being a wave or a particle. So the conscious choice of deciding, am I looking for a particle or a wave, determines the outcome of the experiment. And that leads to the conclusion, well, is the electron a particle or a wave? And, of course, this is where the quantum theorists throw their hands up and say it's both.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the simplest explanation of the two-slit experiment.
And how do you interpret that in terms of consciousness affecting reality?
Well, first of all, if there are theorists, and this would be, for example, Fred Kuttner and Bruce Rosenblum in their book, The Quantum Enigma, the way they interpret that book, and I had Bruce Rosenblum on my own radio show, he believes that conscious choice is the consciousness deciding what reality is. that electron did not have a character until there was a conscious decision to look for the wave or the particle function. In my own view, I would agree with that. But I also think that it shows that consciousness is tied into what we call physical reality. You remember, you know, Heisenberg famously said, atoms are not things. They don't have an independent existence. And this is a truth that we are still struggling with to understand and to incorporate it into our scientific worldview. I think there's a contradiction here, because to me, quantum theory asserts, I'll use your word, asserts that there is this unbreakable bond between the outside physical world and consciousness. At the same time, science proceeds as if there is no connection.
Kind of a conundrum.
Yeah. I think it's a very, medical science is a classic example. I mean, medical science, depending on who you talk to, how many medical scientists say, have positive thoughts and your tumor will heal faster? I mean, there are, energy healers and alternate healers out there with that approach. And there's evidence, the placebo effect and these other, more holistic forms of healing where the mind does alter the physical body. But the entire structure of medical science is based upon the body being a machine that's operating independent of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Although we do have a number of operating rooms which have actually tried to conduct experiments in out-of-body experiences happening at the or near-death experiences happening at the time of death, where they put placards or letters or something on top of filing cabinets or up near the ceiling so that the patient on the operating table obviously can't see them. And then when they die and they come back, there have actually been some surgeons and some other hospital administrators or whatever that have actually tried to find out whether they saw something with an objective reality when they, quote, died and then returned.
Yeah, I think I just use that example. I'm just about done with a new book, and I use that example as proof or as evidence that the brain is not the source of consciousness. Because if the brain is dead, and yet in a out of body or afterlife experience, there's a conscious awareness of the world, then that suggests that consciousness is independent of physical matter.
What would your thoughts be on the idea that the brain is like a transducer, where consciousness resides somewhere else and it's kind of projected like virtual reality into these walking, mechanized biological entities that we wear called bodies, and when something breaks down, then that consciousness is withdrawn from that virtual reality mechanism and waits for another one to kind of be assembled?
Well, the way I look at it, and I think that this view is simple, is that I think the brain comes from consciousness as opposed to the consciousness coming from the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, the hard problem of consciousness, and I'm sure you've had guests on the show talking about this, the hard problem of consciousness is how is it possible for this awareness of the world, this three-dimensional awareness of being here, of subjective experience, how did that arise from this dead matter? And that, of course, is one of the great conundrums, mysteries of modern science. If you turn it upside down and you say, well, we know we have consciousness, we're here, and we know we can project a real world through hallucinations, dreams, seeing stars, all sorts of things. Well, maybe the brain is a physical reflection of the mind.
Mm-hmm. All right. Why did it take you, 40 years to write the book?
Yeah.
I thought I was a slow typist.
Yeah. I think that it's I'm learning as I'm going. That's the best way.
Are you one of those guys like Tom Wolfe where the editors finally had to yank it physically out of his hands and publish the damn thing because he would never have let it go?
Yeah, at some point you just have to put the end.
So who was the editor who yanked your book out of your hands and published The Collapse of Materialism?
Yeah, well, it was. I think that it was a number of things. You know, I just decided that I had to end it because it kept evolving. I kept learning more. Just like we're talking now, every time you get into these topics, you think of something else. Somebody else publishes an article, and so Rainbow Ridge is the publisher, mm-hmm. and I just decided, you know, as you get older, you have to finish things because otherwise, I mean, I don't want to be the type that goes to the grave, assuming there is, I am going to go to the grave, but I don't want to go to the grave with the unfinished manuscript. So, you know, it's that old, it's similar to the other.
So were you looking forward to or not looking forward to standing before the great editor in the sky and saying, well, I had this book, but I have this perfection part of me and I could never make it really the way I – oh, yeah. You're not buying that, okay?
Yeah, no, I know. I've been saying that one adage about don't let perfection be the enemy of good.
Mm-hmm.
That the older I get, if it's good enough. But bottom line is – yeah, I had ended, but I had to learn about it as I'm going. This was not a revelation, you know. There's a lot of research that went into it, a lot of thinking, and it's radical. So I wanted to make it as strong as possible.
You should have on the cover a banner that says 40 years in the making.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, in the next edition, I may try that. That's a good idea. You know, I mean, you never know what's going to work in the publishing world.
So in The Collapse of Materialism, let's start where you were back in 1974. What was the aha moment when you said, I got to write a book on this stuff? I mean, you were an undergraduate. You were in college. You were, what, majoring in philosophy?
Right.
Okay, and you said one day, okay, Spinoza and Plato and Archimedes and all those guys – I'm going to write a book.
Right. Everybody has a book in them, right? I mean, I think that everybody wants to tell their story. And, you know, I don't like to get too corny about all this, but, you know, each of us sort of has something that they're put on the earth for. I mean, hopefully more than one thing. But I felt that I had.
Well, at the rate you write, maybe like three things or four things.
But. I know. Well, luckily, I mean, you have to be balanced too. You can't drive yourself crazy. But you know, bottom line on this, that this was something I always wanted to do. It was in me, and I do think you're correct that there's a certain amount of perfectionism that slows things down, but. There is truth in that. I believe that there's truth in that old, you know, position that each of us has some mission.
So the second book that you're working on now, are you planning to publish it when we like land on Mars in 2035 or 2040?
Well, believe it or not, the second one's 100 pages long. I've learned my lesson.
Okay.
It's 100 pages long, and it's written in a more. It's supposed to be the "Who Moved My Cheese" version of this. So,
I'm missing the allusion. Who moved my what?
Cheese. Who Moved My Cheese? The famous book that was about 50 pages long and sold about 8 million copies.
I don't think I ever saw that.
Really? It was all about. It's about 50 pages about how it's good to adapt to change.
See, I'm familiar with things like Chicken Soup for the Soul and all that, which are these brief little, you know, thingies. But Who Moved My Cheese?
Wow, yeah, that's like one of the best selling books of all time. But you know, I don't blame you for not being aware of it. The only reason I read it is because it was a popular book, and I'm trying to figure out why so many people are reading this book.
I wonder if Donald Trump knows about this book. Nah, he's only focused on.
Should his probably
book.
Read it. He should probably.
So, all right, we've got about 5-10 minutes here. Why don't we start at the beginning of The Collapse of Materialism? What was the key aha moment that made you look around and say, wait a minute, there's got to be more than this?
Well, I think that, to me, there's a couple of things that came together. Believe it or not, my very first semester in college, I read a paper by Heisenberg on the quantum theory.
Okay.
One of his first papers about atoms are not things. And I immediately saw a connection between quantum theory and Berkeley idealism. And Berkeley, you know, and he's not, he's sort of completely ignored now or ridiculed by scientists, even though the University of Berkeley is named after him. You know, he was the one that essentially said the world is a vision in the mind of God. He was an idealist philosopher who believed that mind was central. And so I'm very Berkeleyan. Mm-hmm. And so I immediately saw a connection between idealist philosophy and quantum theory. And then you could bring – then religion comes into the fold because now if God –
Wait. Berkeley was just reiterating, I think, therefore I am.
Well, similar. Berkeley sort of advanced I think he advanced beyond Descartes by concluding that our perception of the physical world is only through our mind, and we do not know anything other than our minds. That when we say that there's matter, that we're assuming that this matter is outside of the mind when we only have ideas. Of matter, and it's sort of a something you got to wrap your head around a little bit. But in about four pages of a book, Berkeley sort of nailed this whole materialistic assumption by saying that we have no reason to think there's anything outside of us. So why do we bother doing it?
This sounds very much like the Matrix.
Yeah, it's similar. Remember Max Planck, the founder of quantum theory, said mind is the matrix of all reality. So all this comes together.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So back to the book. Your big aha moment was?
Was quantum theory being connected to Berkeley idealism, which is science connected to philosophy. And then if God is at the base of reality, which the Hindus and the Eastern philosophers say, now you've connected religion with philosophy, with science.
But why wouldn't you, if you're approaching this, and I presume you were approaching it from a scientific point of view and you kind of fell over the cliff that there may be more than material science behind your perception, your reaction, your awareness, how come you had to put a being there as opposed to a process that in fact is undergoing its own evolution so that as the universe progresses in time and becomes much more complex, it's kind of like people who think that the phone company, if it gets big enough and has enough connections, it'll become self-aware, or the internet. How come you had to put a being at the center as opposed to all our consciousness evolves from a process which ultimately reaches a critical point and then we're aware?
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that I don't want to get tied up with labels. When I say God, I mean the force power that people call God. And so I would agree with you. I mean, Hegel, and I mentioned these philosophers, they're ignored now. Some of them are hard to read, but the German philosopher Hegel said that the mind is in the process of becoming aware of itself, that all history is sort of this churning of the physical world, people becoming more aware of themselves, rising to the realization that mind is all reality.
So he's talking about a conscious evolution.
Right, exactly.
Okay,
right. I completely agree with that. I agree. I could call it consciousness. I could call it God. I mean, all I'm saying is that there is that these different fields begin to join. They join at consciousness, and consciousness is the mystery that we will never solve.
Never is a long, long time. Hold it there. Hold it there. We have a break coming up. Yeah. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Philip Camella. We're discussing consciousness. How are you hearing me and him? How are you hearing yourself? In the land of enchantment, on the other side of midnight, think about that. We shall return. back. You are on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Philip Camilla. And we were poised on that very interesting idea that our consciousness is part of a larger, vaster, intergalactic, intercosmological matrix that's not connected to matter. And it could actually be evolving, and we're part of the main, so we evolve with it. Philip, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that that's very close to where I come down on this. And, you know, right now there is sort of this dichotomy. You have the Roy Kurzweil folks who believe that we're going to join with the machine and that machines are the origin of consciousness. You turn that upside down, and I say, well, we have greater confidence that we are here, that we have consciousness, and that's the Descartes, I think, therefore I am. And why don't we try to explain the world as a reflection of consciousness? It's instead of assuming that a machine sprung, you know, produced consciousness from some kind of mechanical processing.
But wait. If we are consciousness, we're not disembodied consciousness. We must be contained in some matrix of some kind that's stable. Otherwise, our awareness would just dissipate like fog in a high wind. So if the matrix is not in terms of electrons and protons and quarks and all that in this dimension, what is the matrix that holds us and allows us to evolve in complexity and increase in consciousness? If it's not in this dimension, where is the matrix that holds us?
Well, I think that there are some assumptions in that question, that there has to be some kind of container. I mean, I don't see why there needs – I don't know whether that question really has meaning. I like to think about, what do we really know? We know that we're here. We know that we have this driving desire to live. We know that there's a physical world. Awareness is increasing. Now, I don't see a reason to assume that there's some kind of mechanical contraption.
Did I say mechanical?
No.
I said matrix because, look, in some philosophies, like particularly in Eastern philosophies, there is this cliche that became the watchword of the New Age, as above, so below.
Right.
So if you look at organization and the way you can store information below, meaning in our three-dimensional reality,
right,
why would that as above, so below, which comes from a lot of philosophy that's not part of the Western, you know, Greek tradition, why would you throw that away and not look for the higher level, higher dimensional matrix, which may not be atoms and quarks and whatever, but it must be some kind of organized structure. Otherwise, entropically, consciousness could not maintain. There must be some mechanism to maintain the field, if I'm going to use that term borrowed from 3D.
Well, I think that it's will and desire holds things together. See, maybe I'm extremely radical on this, but David Hume, I mean, when you go to the people who really thought about this, David Hume said that needs and beliefs ultimately hold the world together. And then Schopenhauer, the other German idealist, said that, you know, he had his book, The World as Will and Representation. He believed that the will, the determination, our desire holds things together. Okay, now, and I could be wrong here, Richard. I'm saying that.
Well, we all could be wrong. I mean, obviously, this part of the conversation is we could all be wrong.
I mean, we're both sort of trying to get our hands around something that's so hard to define. I mean, I go back to the Upanishads where they say, you know, the inexpressible one. You know, we're trying to describe things that it might be indescribable. Mm-hmm. And so we're all using these words to try to, you know, get a better understanding of it. You know, where I come down is what we really know, and try to explain the world with as few assumptions as possible, because I think that's what science is about. And I think science has really departed from that basic, you know, Occam's razor principle where fewer the assumptions, the better.
Well, I come back to the hospital idea, where you have doctors, really interesting doctors, I actually know some of them, and they've set up these little experiments when they're operating on someone and they die, and then they come back and they report that they died and came back. They ask them questions. Did you see what's on top of the filing cabinets? Can you describe what's up there? And that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And these people are successfully able to do this. Now, that automatically says that consciousness is not connected and tied irrevocably to the brain, the human brain as we understand it physiologically.
Right.
But that also doesn't answer the question then, okay, in what matrix is that consciousness actually stored, operating, able to affect will, desire, move in certain directions, look and see things like they were in a body? I mean, that's what they report, except they're not in a body. They're in what's called the etheric body in terms of some of the ways this is described. So what is that matrix and where is it? And why, if you're in that matrix, cannot you affect the so-called physical world? Because I don't know of any examples where, you know, later it was reported that lights were turned out, computers were turned off, you know, words appeared on the computer like the disembodied consciousness was trying to communicate through other means. They either were in their body or they were not. They can report on the room when they come back into their body, but they need that body to affect actually to affect the three-dimensional material world that we all kind of take for granted.
Yeah, I mean, I follow that, and this is where I'm at with this right now. I do think, I mean, there's a field of consciousness, okay, and that's really what, to me, the universe is, and there are levels of awareness within consciousness. Now, I am not proclaiming things here. I'm giving you my best guess. Okay,
it's a guess that's based on 40 years of guessing. So
right,
it's
I'm guessing, but I've had a lot of people on my show who talk about multi dimensions and coming in the afterlife and out of body, mm-hmm. and I have been convinced that there are levels of consciousness,
levels of consciousness,
levels or dimensions of consciousness.
Okay, we're not talking like IQ tests where you have more conscious people and less conscious people. Yeah. What is you're actually saying?
I'm saying that if there is one mind, one consciousness that permeates what we call the universe, then we are part.
Which we could call the mind of God if you want to.
We call it the zero point field or whatever you want to call it. But then we are embodied spirits participating in the dream of God, living out God's story of becoming aware of itself.
Why do you call it a dream?
Well, because I think that the dream best describes where we're at and what the world is. Because we have personal experiences. I was going to say this. We experience every day multi-dimensional levels or stages of consciousness when we go to sleep and we dream.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's the dream occurring. The dream isn't occurring in our living room. The dream is occurring in a different world of consciousness. And then when you add, to me, some of the most fascinating stories are precognitive dreams or remote viewing where someone has a dream of something that occurs the next day. Or they have a dream that their child in Europe who's on a way at school got injured.
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible? You know, I mean, you could say that all those stories are just a bunch of bunk, but if you read enough of them, and even if one's true, then how was that possible unless there is a connection, a deep emotional connection of some kind that got communicated? You know, and this kind of stuff, well, that's really weird. But the fact of the matter is that there's so many.
Well, we have the same problem in quantum mechanics.
Exactly.
You know, remember the famous Bell inequality theorem?
Right, exactly.
And I'll explain for, again, the folks that aren't following. If you take two atoms, just two atoms, and you set them in a state where they're identical in their rotation, their momentum, their quantum state, as it's called. And then you take one of them and you move it to the other end of the galaxy, the Milky Way, 100,000 light years away. And you change the state of the one still on Earth in your laboratory. You either, you know, hit it with light, or you, you know, raise the temperature around it, or you hit it with radiation. Or according to experiments which have been conducted now, overwhelmingly confirmed, the second atom, the one that you connected it to, the one that you paired it with, the one that shared all of its original characteristics, it will instantaneously, not limited by the speed of light, but instantaneously change its state, no matter where it is in the universe, to the identical state of the one that you're working with in the lab, even if it's at the other end of the galaxy or the other end of, you know, the Virgo cluster or whatever. How do you explain that interesting experiment, which demonstrates what we call non-locality, but it also demonstrates that somehow information is being communicated between those two pieces of matter at multiples, billions of times the speed of whatever light is? And where is that information going, and how does it get to the other particle to inform it what the original guy is now doing?
Yes, I think that that's a good example of entanglement of the connection between the universe. And, you know, there's another.
And how is the information transmitted from that one particle to the other one?
Right, exactly. And this is an example of what we discussed earlier, Richard, which is that modern science is looking at this, and it's telling them, hey guys, there seems to be a connection out there that we can't explain. We cannot explain through our physical laws, because that entanglement is faster than the speed of light. We thought the speed of light was supposed to be the speed limit.
But doesn't that just say that our current, you know, laws of physics are incomplete? Kind of in the extreme?
Right. And I think that the law that we're missing is that consciousness is at the root of reality. We're missing the dreaming or...
Yeah, but wait. How can two particles, just two simple little particles, have a consciousness?
Well, the particles, in my opinion, are a reflection of consciousness. And I think that, you know, science loves to look at these little particles as being ultimate reality, as evidenced by the God particle, which I would love to talk about. So when science looks at their particles, all they're saying is that one aspect of what we're calling independent physical reality seems to have this interconnectedness that's not supposed to be there. What I'm saying in a different way is, well, this would also apply to faraway galaxies. I mean, people don't understand, because science does a good job of camouflaging this, that there's something called the horizon problem, which I don't know whether you've studied it, but the horizon problem with the Big Bang is very similar to entanglement, but on a large scale. When the universe expanded, supposedly, at the Big Bang, scientists had this conundrum. Well, how is it that the temperatures out there in outer space at the far ends of the cosmos are in balance? Why is it, I think it's 2.7 degrees Kelvin. Mm-hmm. The temperature cannot be the same across the cosmos, because the light would not have had a chance to communicate.
Well, are you aware of what's called inflation theory?
Right.
As the Big Bang expanded in those first nanoseconds, the model... introduced by a physicist named Alan Guth, I believe, at MIT, right, is that there was this intense period of super, super luminal expansion.
Right.
So that the eventual, when the expansion slowed back down to the speed of light, everything within that bubble, that expanding, seething, hot plasma bubble, was basically at the same uniform temperature, and that's how they explain the apparent... dichotomy that you have events going on opposite ends of the universe that apparently are connected, but in fact in this model they once were connected, and the conditions were established when they were extraordinarily tiny, and then that tininess, that matrix, that frozen state simply expanded in its form established after those first few nanoseconds.
Right, right. And I think that, and there's, I have a section on the inflationary Big Bang in my book, and I've written about it. When you think about it, the inflationary Big Bang is a big mathematical contrivance to cover up, I'm sorry to use that term, to cover up evidence of design, because no one's ever proven that inflation could have occurred. It's all it is a computer model trying to sort of, to me, cover up or put the rug over the evidence of design. Paul Steinhardt, the Princeton professor of physics, who was one of the originators of the inflationary Big Bang, wrote an article in Scientific American about 3 or 4 years ago, where after the calculations, he said that he's now distancing himself from the inflationary Big Bang because it actually requires more fine-tuning than the original Big Bang. Because in order to do all these wonderful things that Alan Guth said, it has to be a finely tuned inflation. Mm-hmm.
But isn't the answer is that if it wasn't finely tuned, we wouldn't be here to wonder about it? So in terms of it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, we're here because the tuning was exactly right, and that's just kind of out of a million universes that might form. The one we're in is the one that works because we're in it.
Right, right. And I would explain it much
more. I think that's called the anthropic principle.
Yeah, yeah. I would explain it much, much more simply. And I think the anthropic principle is close. I would say take your pen out and write a story about the kind of world you want to live in. And the story, and you would probably write a story that you want to live in a world of order, regularity, consistency.
Have you watched CNN lately?
Pardon?
Have you watched CNN lately?
Yeah, yes.
We're not in that world.
No, I agree with you on that. I agree.
So if our universe is being controlled by people who are desiring and making, manifesting their wish for the perfect universe as they envision it, obviously the powerful minds are nuts and crazy and totally out of control, because look around.
Yeah.
The universe is not ordered and peaceful and conducive to, as Carl used to say, the survival of beagles and begonias.
Right, right. I would agree with that. My point being that if you go to a consciousness or mind first reality, the fine tuning just it solves itself. You don't have to explain it as some kind of mystery of particles in motion. It's a story. It's a harmonious story written by a mind who wants to live in a world of order. You know, Kant, probably the greatest thinker ever, who's very hard. Well, a lot of people don't read him, but the German philosopher. He basically said that the laws of physics have their root in the structure of the human mind. It's order that the mind imposes upon the world. And he was so radical on this thought, but no one's ever disproven him. I'm a Kantian too. That's exactly what I think. I think that the mind imposes order, and so it's sort of similar when you think about it.
Yeah, but the mind, if we remember, we just talked about CNN, the mind is imposing disorder. There's not order anywhere within light years of us. Incredible chaos is ensuing with little pockets of order. Yeah. But most of the universe, or at least the human universe in terms of the planet, is not at all what anybody that I can imagine would actually wish for.
Well, two points. Point one, I'm obviously talking about the laws of nature and the regularity of planets and chemistry and physics and why there's order in the world.
So how do you separate that immense cosmological order that we do see from the local chaos of human beings trying to live day to day and just survive?
Well, I thought you touched upon it earlier. We are becoming aware, consciously aware, of who we are. We don't know who we are. We're in a state of disarray. We think that we're all separate people living our own lives with our own agendas. We don't agree upon anything. I think that's the root of why we live in a world of human chaos, because we don't have anything that we can agree upon. And, you know, this sort of goes to the Pope story a little bit. At least you have a leader trying to, you know, a moral leader trying to find something in common, like poverty. But you know, we don't have, and I think it goes back to the feud between old-style religion and materialistic science. See, I think that the problem we have is we are at a lower level of a conscious awareness of this lower level of evolution of consciousness. We think that we're so doggone advanced because we have all this technology, but you know, we're technology smart and consciousness dumb,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion. And so we think that we're so intelligent because we have all these gizmos and we could fly people to the moon and spaceships and stealth aircraft, but our consciousness hasn't kept up with the evolution of technology. And I'm saying we need to rise up and educate ourselves, think a little bit, get off of the cell phones a little bit. And frankly, I think it is a gradual, natural process. And I think, you know, it's something that's going to happen. It may take generations, centuries, millennium, who knows. But I do think over time, consciousness does rise to gradually understand who it is, find something to agree upon, and hopefully we have a better world. Will it happen tomorrow? No way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that you have to have hope, and I think that is the other advantage of a consciousness-based worldview, where we actually could talk about purpose and goals, and we could direct ourselves places, as opposed to just throwing the dice and hoping that, you know, it turns up, you know, snake eyes or whatever.
You made a statement. I was reading some of the article that you'd published in, I think, Eden magazine.
Right.
You made a statement there that science has not developed any mechanisms for measuring consciousness.
Hmm.
Is that actually a view that you hold strongly?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what the sentence that you're referring to. I think that the measurement issue is something that holds back the consciousness movement in terms of measuring conscious awareness. In fact, I think there's a guy ahead of my show. I think his name is Richard Barrett, who has a method of measuring consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if I'm disagreeing with my own article or what. But,
well, that kind of leaped out at me because...
And let me make myself clear. I reserve the right to edit myself. But anyways, I do think there's ways to do it, and maybe I learned more since I wrote that article. But, you know, you can't take the ruler out and do it. You can't weigh consciousness. But I think there's some levels.
Well, let me kind of tell you what I'm thinking about. As the listeners to this show know, Robin and I have traveled around the world with this little technological gadget that I put together from some hints from my departed friend Bruce De Palma and modern, you know, computer technology. It's basically a little tuning fork connected to a computer program that allows you to chart the frequency.
Hmm.
And the tuning fork is supposed to be at one frequency, you know, 360 hertz, 360 cycles per second, plus or minus, you know, 0.001, because electronic feedback circuits are very good, and you can keep that tuning fork tuned very precisely, very close to 360. What happened actually in 2012 is that I took this technology to one of the very famous Central American sacred sites, a place called Chichen Itza. There's a very large pyramid built at Chichen Itza and a bunch of smaller ones. And I was able to actually emplace the equipment and watch what happens on the computer screen as two separate consciousness events were going on.
Mm.
One was one individual who simply held the Accutron technology in his or her hands. I'm going to keep, you know, who they are quiet for the time being because they don't want any exposure. And I saw a radical change in the frequency just from this individual holding the Accutron, which is the watch with the tuning fork, in their hand. When they put it down, the readings returned to normal. Now, you would say, okay, there's some kind of electrical potential. There was some mechanism whereby the tuning fork electrically picked up brain activity, alpha, beta, whatever, you know, skin resistance, except we're dealing with non-conductive surfaces, and all the individual did was to hold it in a plastic case, so there was no conductivity, and the frequency changed dramatically and then returned to normal when the individual put it down. The second experiment was the Accutron was set up, and there were about 100 people who were conducting a meditation ceremony in front of the Kukulcan Pyramid there at Chichen Itza, located probably 400 or 500 feet away from the instrumentation. They're on the other side of the square, kind of is around the pyramid. And what happened is that the federales showed up, literally Mexican police, and they notified these people that they were performing a group meditation, but 100 or people or more or less, all wearing white. And they had to disperse. They had to break up. They were breaking the law. They didn't have the right permits. They had to leave. And, of course, they were shocked. They were emotionally very anguished at that moment. And the Accutron tuning fork frequency, exactly as this was taking place, showed dramatically different readings than it had before. And then, you know, like an hour or so later, when they returned to normal, when the group dispersed. So these two measurements, and I've obviously got to do more, but these two measurements convinced me that consciousness is somehow interacting with the field, what we call the torsion field or the ether, and the modalities that the Accutron was measuring, which was basically merely changes in its mass, changes in its inertia, that somehow the collective power of 100 or more human minds were able to affect the mass of that little tuning fork and change it quite unwillingly, just as a side effect of their emotional response to being told they couldn't do what they had come literally thousands of miles to do. Now, we need to have more data, but to me, that was a remarkable example of two separate ways of measuring both individual and collective consciousness. And so when I talked about the Pope arriving in Washington and invoking prayer for his activities, his work, his mission, his intent, I was not whistling Dixie, because this kind of experimentation, together with the kind of experiments that Art Bell has conducted over many, many, many years, have demonstrated to me that, yes, consciousness can be harnessed, consciousness can be made coherent, consciousness can be made to have effects in our 3D reality, provided you know how to interpret the measurements that are showing you what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's great, and I think that that is evidence, you know, who knows how strong, but it's definitely evidence of a consciousness field, you know, the power of united consciousness. It reminds me, I don't know if you're familiar with the Dean Radin's experiment.
Oh, of course, yes. The so-called Princeton eggs and all that. Well, I'll tell you what, hold it there, Philip. We have another break coming. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we will be right back. Somebody's trying over on me. I got a little angel setting me free. When the world is on my shoulder, my little angel climbs in, says move over. When the world comes down on me, I got a little angel setting me free. And we are back. My guest this morning is Philip Camella. We're talking about his book, The Collapse of Materialism, The Underpinnings of a Consciousness That, in fact, according to Philip's perspective, affects and molds and shapes all our realities. Philip, why don't we go back to the book and you tell me how you laid it out in terms of educating the reader to move from the materialistic Newtonian view to some of the thoughts we've been expressing tonight.
Well, I think it begins with defining terms, which is defining mind and world, and understanding that, at least the way I'm approaching things, that you have to separate the inner from the outer, the mind being the internal awareness of ourselves, our thoughts, hopes, desires, feelings, the physical world being everything outside of us. And then I sort of start easing the reader into the topic by discussing the paranormal, synchronicity.
Let me stop you there. Why do you call it paranormal? I hate that word.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think that I would agree with those who would describe that as being normal things that we don't understand. I mean, I would agree with you. I mean, I think that I'm not sure what term you like, but
to me, everything is normal.
Yeah.
You know, it's back to Sagan. Remember Sagan's great definition that people have glommed onto for decades and decades, and they spout without understanding what it means? You know, the extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence.
Right.
Wrong.
Yes.
Wrong, pale face. Because if you set in science parameters that some observation or some phenomena is more extraordinary than another, that sets up a subjective psychological set of goalposts that can be moved at whim anytime, because a critic of your model can say, oh, well, you haven't assembled extraordinary enough evidence. We can't pay attention to you. So what Sagan was doing was basically undercutting all of science with a glib phrase that everybody parrots without understanding that he basically drove a dagger through the heart of objective reality, pauperism, I guess you might call it, by measuring phenomena as equal and simply weighing evidence, as opposed to saying some evidence has to be much more extraordinary because the phenomena is so much extraordinary.
I completely agree with you. I mean, that's exactly where I am, and where I started the show by talking about where lawyering comes in. Where you look at the facts and the evidence, I don't care. And I think we should be applying the same critical thinking to religion, science, what people call the paranormal, all the energy healing, all these claims. We should find the same mindset.
So if you were in front of a judge and you were making an opening argument, and you've actually argued cases in front of, including, I believe, the Supreme Court?
I have not argued in front of the Supreme Court, but I have appeared in front of the Supreme Court.
Oh, okay. Okay. So if you were arguing in front of a court,
right,
how would you lay out your premise? What would you state about the premise in terms of trying to make the case that life is a lot more than atoms and quarks and whatever?
Well, it all comes down to, I would say, let's compare the two separate worldviews. And the simplest way to look at this is where did all this stuff come from, and why does it operate with the precision of a Swiss timepiece? What we forget, and this goes to the point you just made, Richard, is that everybody assumes the Big Bang is correct, but nobody knows where all this stuff came from. If you contrast that with our ability to dream, we've all dreamt. Many of us have had hallucinations. We understand that the mind is capable of projecting a real seeming world from nothing, without a Big Bang. Phantom limbs is another example where somebody imagines their arm is really there when it's not, and they feel pain. We know that the power of the mind is capable of doing that. And then when you move to the next big mystery of modern science, which is how does all this stuff stay together with such regularity? Why do we call these things laws? Why is science even possible? How can this occur in a world where if there's just matter detached from consciousness or mind?
And okay, let me stop you there again, because I've been a hobbyist. I make stuff, you know, in home workshops and all that. And the essence of craftsmanship is that no two things are the same. That's what makes crafts valuable. That's why, you know, great art has such immense value now, or great sculpture or whatever, because it's not made on a machine. It's not uniform. Every piece is individual as the guy or gal who was behind it. However, atoms, electrons, all the other stuff that we're cataloging appear in all the experiments to be absolutely identical. identical, like they'd been turned out by some huge mega machine down to 0.00000, beyond where we can actually measure with current technology at the femto level, which is, well, I forget, like a trillionth of a second or something. So how can human consciousness, which is kind of all over the map, have ordered such incredible, precise, robotic regularity in the universe in which it inhabits?
Well, at least we know it's possible that the mind can dream. To me, the united mind projects the forms. We project the physical image, the small parts, like notes to a song, the inner harmony of the atom's DNA molecule, the solar system model of the atom. Those are the notes of the song. The outer harmony determines the inner harmony.
Yeah, we know the solar system, the Bohr model, is wrong. So,
right. Well, all I'm saying is that when you look inside, what's amazing, it doesn't matter how deep you look into what we call reality, we find order.
Mm-hmm.
We find order. And I'm saying that if you had a choice, column A, answer A is this happened through a miracle of the random shuffling of particles from the Big Bang, or it occurred through the united mind that desired a world of harmony. Two, that the mind is at the root, is much more probable. I think we're talking about probabilities here.
No, but again, we're not talking about one mind. We're talking on this planet, 7 billion. If you look at the galaxy, there's probably hundreds and billions and trillions of minds out there. And then how do you account for the other minds that are like in our midst? Dogs, cats, dolphins, spiders, birds. Are right. They conscious? Are they contributing to the creation of a consensus reality? And again, how do out of very individualistic characteristics of all the human minds I know, how do we get this absolutely incredible, methodical, mathematical, precise matrix of overwhelming regularity?
Well, let me connect two points here that make this exciting. Before the break, you were talking about the experiment that you were using with your Accutron,
mm-hmm.
and this whole point about measuring sort of mass consciousness.
Well, there is actually a connection to the Pope's visit and all that, and so let me give it to you.
Yeah.
There have been, you know, he canonized Junipero Serra, who was the Spanish monk that came to California and set up all the missions up and down the California coast. First time a saint has been canonized in the United States by a pope, right?
Right.
There are stories of saints, I forget which one I'm thinking of, who were actually able to levitate. They apparently were able to somehow cut off or change or modulate gravity, and literally in moments of intense focus and prayer and meditation, other witnesses, scores of them in many different countries and continents, witnessed them literally rising up, floating off the floor, off their chair or whatever, and hovering in midair. Now that's obviously an extraordinary demonstration of the consciousness affecting physical reality and changing the parameters that we think of as inertia and mass and gravity. And what I'm seeing in our experiments, our Accutron experiments, is a little teeny tiny version where the conscious mind could basically change the inertia of an objective instrument in their vicinity to where its mass changed and therefore the frequency changed. If that's going on, if we can see this in individuals who are intensely religious or intensely focused or intensely into meditation, and they can change such a fundamental Newtonian parameter as their mass, and they can just float away like a thistle in the wind, does that not say that if we really, really try, an incoherent mind can become coherent enough to actually begin to control the world around it?
Yes, and that's exactly where I'm going.
Oh, good.
that's exactly where I'm going. Now, let me connect a couple things here. We talked about rising of consciousness, okay? So mm-hmm. I think that we are living out the story of the mind of God, or we could call it the spirit or the consciousness. We don't have to use the word God. That we are.
Well, no. If you say God, that means there's a self-aware being who is consciously creating and focusing and holding in reality, in existence, through force of will, what we perceive to be reality around us.
Okay, well, that's not sort of. I have an article I wrote. It's called "The Evolving Mind of God," and I do think God or the mind evolves, and so I don't think that God is like an absolute creature out there or being out there that knows everything and just waiting for stuff to happen.
Okay, you're saying that there is some matrix in which consciousness, this vast mega consciousness, exists, and that is learning as this timey-wimey ball of stuff, to quote Doctor Who, evolves.
Exactly. Now let me connect this here for a second by using this question. Why do we see the same sky? Modern science says we see the same sky because there's one sky out there apart from us. Okay, mm-hmm. I say,
and it's blue because of Rayleigh scattering.
Right. I say we see the same sky because we have the same mind and we're participating in the same dream. In our bodies, our current state here, we are at a lower level of consciousness. We're like gold kernels being shaken through that pan. We're embodied spirits in dreams, in these levels of prayer, of deep emotion. Drugs, epiphanies. We rise up. We rise up, and we gather more of the strength. We go to a different stage, level, dimension of consciousness, and we start tapping into the power of the mind of God. Or an example, and I don't want to get too out there with this, even though maybe I'm out there anyways. But this is similar to the athlete's zone. It's nothing. It happens all the time. And maybe your example with the levitation, the out-of-body experiences, we see this all the time. And so this is where things get exciting, because I think as the critical mass builds up, Richard, then the control over the world increases.
Wait. When you say critical mass, you mean in an individual mind or in our collective 7 billion-plus people on the Earth time?
The collective. The collective. I think there is a horizontal dimension, which is critical mass of people, and I think there's a depth to it, horizontal, vertical. So mm-hmm. depth, by depth, I mean understanding, not just a superficial kind of like I'm in it for the money, but understanding, you know, prayer. You define, you know, focus, intention is the word you use, which I think is one way to put it, meditation, yoga, whatever.
I just thought it was stunning that the Pope looks at the camera, looks at the guy and says, pray for me. I need you to pray for me, which is another way of saying, without you, without the collective, without everybody focusing on me and making what I'm trying to do work, it can't work.
Yeah. It's sort of like, when you think about it, it's sort of like the belief of the people give him his power.
Yeah. And he was saying it on live national television.
Yeah.
For those who could understand what he was saying.
Yeah.
In the middle of this incredible temple, which amplifies enormously the background field, again, according to our experiments. Let me ask you a key question. The really cool part about philosophers is they never have to prove anything, because there's no experiments, there's no, you know, Popperian, you know, process, there's no prediction. You basically can limb out any idea you want, and it just sits out there, and someone can say, oh, I like it, or I don't like it. Have you thought of ways to test scientifically any of the propositions in your book, The Collapse of Materialism?
Yes, and I challenge the reader at the end of the book by saying that we are living the experiment right now. I mean, and Richard, I'm very sensitive to what you're saying, that I think that just talking about this stuff doesn't advance the ball, because you talk about it and then you go back to normal reality and you forget it. Unless you see real results in the physical world, it's sort of happy thoughts.
Well, one of the things we're doing as an experiment in terms of this audience, and we have a global reach. I mean, we get emails from all over the world. I had a guy the other night from South Africa who closed out the show really, really nicely, very elegantly. All those people, I'm trying to focus at the moment on President Jimmy Carter, who announced very tragically that he has cancer. And what we're trying to do is to basically make him well again, to put him back in resonance with the field, with his original DNA matrix, whatever, however you want to, you know, use this term. In other words, Jimmy's got work left to do. He's 90-some, and he's sharp as, you know, when he was 30. It would be a tragedy for him to be missing from planet Earth for the next, you know, couple of decades, because he's got stuff to do. He's doing important, crucial work. He's advancing everyday people. He's advancing the idea of we are our brother's keeper. He's advancing the idea we're all part of a global community. He's a positive guy, and we would be a lot less well off if we were to lose him. So we're focusing the intention. And what I've said to this audience is, it's not just the thousands of us, and we're growing daily, you know, in terms of numbers, but potentially to make this work, you got to have millions. Well, how can a few thousand people affect millions? The idea is that when Carter announced his problem, all over the world, millions of people felt the same way. Oh, you can't have cancer. You must not have cancer. You must somehow fix your cancer, et cetera, et cetera. So what I've told our folks is we can form what's called a coherent pilot wave, where we can entrain the consciousness of so many more millions of people who all are incoherently kind of thinking the same thing, but they're not focusing their intention the way we are. So we can kind of guide the beam, mixing our metaphors madly, to create a different reality for Jimmy Carter than entropy has dealt him at the moment.
Yes, and I think that that's the kind of experiment that the new world needs. And because we'll never know if that works, Richard, unless you do something like that.
Well, we watched it with Art Bell. I mean, I'm alive because Art Bell, when I had the heart attack, you know, like 18 years, 17 years ago, and I really almost died, he told the audience at that time when he was on premiere, and there were millions of people, he basically had them focus on me. And I can tell you, Philip, I felt it. It was like being struck by a bolt of electricity. There was a difference between, you know, before that show, which was, I think, on a Monday night, because I'd gotten through the weekend with drugs and, you know, things that Robin had stuffed in me, prophylactics and homeopathics and all that. But that Monday night, there was something that changed. And then the people were taking pictures, of course, and they were posted on the web. And some of my enemies said, oh, come on, Hoagland's got to be hoaxing his heart attack. He looks hale as a horse. And it's because I felt that input of something. And I also could feel when it drifted away, because people's consciousness changed, their attention spans, their day-to-day activities, other interesting things, entertainment, movies, news, other programs. And I could feel when that support kind of slowly dissipated, and I was back to drugs and menstruations and doctors and all that. But for that brief period of like 48 hours, to me it was absolutely palpably obvious that something was different. Something had come in to give me a lift, pun intended, and here we are.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great story. And when you think about it, there's not that much difference between what you just described, and Larry Dossey has a lot of similar stories in his books, and what the medical profession calls bedside manner. When you read up on the placebo effect and how strong belief heals.
Except I didn't know all this was going on.
Well,
I was not in the condition to be listening to Art Bell in the middle of the night on Monday night. I was in the process of dying.
Yeah.
So this all happened without me being consciously aware of anything.
Well, that's
how do you explain that?
Well, that's where I'm going with this, which is that there is a I don't know whether it's a multidimensional or a spiritual connection. I'm not sure what word we want to use, but this is exactly what I'm saying, is that we are connected. Carl Jung said that, talked about the collective unconsciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what I am saying.
That, yeah, but in this case, it was collective consciousness. These people were consciously trying to keep me alive,
right,
focused by the band director, Art Bell.
Right.
And it worked.
Right. Now, just think how powerful it would be. And if you haven't realized this, I'm extremely idealistic. Just think how powerful it would be if the ability to do that, what healed you, was accepted as a scientific truth, and therefore, and we agreed hundreds of years from now that when people act together, not only physically, but emotionally, spiritually, that they can change the world, change themselves. Now you're talking about building a much bigger, better world, a much better world. Now you're talking about actually improving the physical world and taking ourselves out of this chaos, of course.
Well, in other words, creating more order against the negentropy surrounding us.
Exactly, exactly. And so I think that, going beyond this a little bit, it's very simple. If we are one, then morality is written into our souls, and cooperating is good for everybody. It's sort of like the ultimate win-win, because you cooperate and your power or your teamwork sort of improves the performance of the team. And that's sort of what you're saying, I think, when you're talking about this critical mass, or the people praying for Jimmy Carter, or the people directing their focus and attention to you when you had your heart attack. Just imagine if that was considered to be real and authentic in our scientific mindset, how powerful.
But there are a lot of hospitals now that have active programs where they encourage their websites devoted to people praying for total strangers.
Yeah.
And there are people watching and monitoring this, and I'm kind of wondering, have you been following, other than the Princeton eggs, have you been following when this actually works with real people, and what happens before and after, like my story?
No, I only anecdotally. I mean, Larry Dossey, as I mentioned, has written many books about the power of prayer. And I have not read up on these recent stories, but I'm encouraged, Richard, that this is occurring. And you were saying before about, well, how do you prove this stuff? This is how you prove it,
mm-hmm.
Right? By experimenting with whether it's the Accutron, whether it's focused intention, whether it's mass prayer. This is how, Dean Radin is a pioneer in doing this. And he's, I think it's been proven, I don't know whether it's been proven or whether the results are suggestive, but the point is that it's definitely showing that there's something here. There's something to this critical mass, this focused intention, that can create a better world or can affect the physical world. And that has to be extremely exciting, because it's a lot better doing it that way than taking a bunch of pills and going through chemotherapy and all the, don't get me started on modern medical cures.
Okay, let me ask another question then. Are you aware of something called the Maharishi effect?
I think I have heard of it. Why don't you describe it?
Okay, in the 90s, I'm forgetting exactly which part of the 90s, but in the 90s, for several months, there was a focused intention experiment coordinated around Washington, D.C., to basically try to lower the crime rate in a very conscious manner.
Yes, I remember. Yep.
And
yes.
Statistics were collected before, during, and after. And there's a definite, I mean, like 20-30% drop in crime, with only a few people doing this on a regular basis in D.C., which had a huge crime wave going on. That's, in fact, where the Enterprise mission was created, at the height of that crime wave. And we literally did not know if the students we said goodbye to at night would be the same folks that would come back through the door the next morning, because there were so many drive-bys and so many kids were accidentally being shot as part of drug wars and, you know, gangs, you know, territorial disputes and all that. But the Maharishi effect, as it's now called, seemed to have dramatically affected, with just consciousness, the statistics of people hating and killing each other at an unprecedented rate, and it had a material effect, and yet it doesn't seem to have been replicated in any large scale, either certainly before or since. Why not?
Yeah, I don't know why not, but
well, maybe it was too effective.
Right. Yeah, that's a good
point. I'm serious. Remember, there seem to be entities in our culture, in our civilization, who are working their damnedest to create fear and loathing and terror and desperation and poverty and all the other things that keep us mired from understanding that our consciousness can conquer a lot of things.
Well, I would completely agree with that. And this goes to a fundamental point that is it is in the beginning of my book, which is that you cannot doubt yourself, and the media and the mainstream scientific community, so many of them poo-poo this and put doubts in the minds of people that all this stuff is just a bunch of happy talk. And so therefore we start doubting ourselves that this stuff will work. Where does that lead us? I live outside Chicago. We have a terrible crime situation in Chicago. Where does it lead? It leads to getting more police, to beating people up, to more shootings, because they're trying to fix things from the outside in. Now, I'm not saying this is an easy problem to solve, and I don't have the solution. All I'm saying is that we've got to change our perspective a little bit and try some of these other methods, whether it's the Maharishi, whether it's education, whether it's understanding or meetings or whatever. But the point is that I don't think you change people by beating them over the head.
Agreed. So right. Hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. You're on the other side of midnight, everybody. My guest this morning is Philip Camella. We're discussing consciousness and rearranging the world to the kind of world we'd like to live in. Wouldn't that be remarkable? We'll be right back. And we are back. My guest this morning is Philip Camella. We're discussing consciousness. I want to quote something that one of our listeners just sent me. I rarely go over and look at email during the show because it's distracting. But I thought something just told me I should do that, so I did. And one of our regular callers, Lou, said you should use this quote from the Pope's address. That was, I guess, this morning at the meeting he had with the president. We know that things can change. Think about that. The Pope said, we know that things can change. And he's doing what he's doing and asking for help so things can change.
Yeah, I think that that's a good sign. And, so many of us think that we are rooted in this us against them, this dichotomy out there, Muslims versus the Christians and the Jews and the Republicans versus the Democrats, Iranians versus the U.S. I mean, and we need to change. Yeah, I think that is a really good message myself, Richard, and I think that it's helpful to have a moral leader sort of say that kind of thing in public.
Well, a lot of people need lessons. They need – I mean, why do we have leaders? Because most people need someone to give them guides to kind of direct their thinking into various other possibilities than what they're used to, what they think is normal, reality, the way things are.
Right, right.
And to me, that's what – you know, even if you're not a Catholic, what I'm intrigued with is that everybody seems to be looking at this one individual in this location – and anticipating that his very presence will somehow effect change. And I find that very, very positive.
Well, you know, I am not a fan. I mean, like a lot of people, I was raised Catholic. I am not a fan of the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Church and the whole Orthodox structure and all that. But I do think that it is very interesting that the universal attention being given to the Pope, particularly in this country, and to me it is a function of the lack of leadership we have in this country, particularly on moral issues.
That's interesting. But remember, this is not your ordinary average Pope. This is a guy who came in after the previous guy resigned, which hasn't happened for 1,000 years, like it was preparing the runway for the new experiment. Yeah. And it's the first time a Jesuit has been elected to be Pope. It's the first time a non-European has been elected, you know, someone from the New World, mixing our metaphors very interestingly.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't say it's a lack of local domestic leadership so much as it's the fact that in the last couple of years, this guy who has the voice and heart of about 1.5 billion Catholics and a lot more people around the world look to him as a spiritual, as a consciousness leader, they're looking at him and saying, I wonder what he's going to do next, because he's not been just talking about stuff, he's been doing stuff.
Yeah, and isn't it healthy to have somebody who is a leader to be talking about issues that sort of help the world? I mean, poverty, climate change are two of the things that he's been focusing
and
on.
And community.
Right, community, correct, yes. And it's really encouraging to have somebody of that stature coming out and saying it and not being and afraid about getting elected or how he's going to
oh. No, it's kind of hard to see him being thrown out of office.
Yeah. And so it's sort of, you know, I'm wondering whether some sort of candidates are on the edge of their seat figuring out whether the Pope's going to agree with their position or not.
Oh, tomorrow's going to be extraordinary. Later today. Yeah. I keep saying tomorrow because it feels like night. It is night here in the desert. Okay, why don't we take a couple of calls? I've got people who want to ask questions. I'm sure that they may ask better questions than I am because they've had 2 hours now to think about stuff. If you want to call us, our number here is 505-796-8802. That's 505-796-8802. Or on Skype, which I would prefer because Skype sounds so cool, Enterprise Mission. That's our Skype handle, our Skype name, Enterprise Mission. So if you want to ask Philip a question about why it took him 40 years to write a book, maybe he'll tell us some things that he learned along the way. In fact, let me ask that while we're waiting for people to get the courage to talk about this subject. What did you learn from the beginning in 74 to when you finally published the book?
Well, I think that the number one thing is that there is a way to express this. I mean, I have struggled through the years in trying to find a way to express it that was understandable, that would not just sound mystical or new agey or otherworldly. To me, it's very important to be understood. And so I spent a lot of that time trying to put this in, you know, words that most people can understand. Now, I don't think I completely succeeded, but most people who read it believe that I have been kind to the reader. And that is something very important. I also came up with this, I call it the real dream worldview. That's the motif or the system. And that was sort of a step I thought I made in understanding this, because when people say, oh, you think the world's a dream, isn't that weird? The world's, it's much more solid, regular than a dream. And I say, well, we're part of the dream. It's real to us.
Did you explore in the book anything about the Aboriginal Australians and the Dreamtime?
No, I don't.
Oh, darn.
I don't, but I think I found out about them after I wrote the book, but I think that's a, you know, interesting offshoot, and frankly, I think a lot of the Aborigines, whether in the U.S. as well, they think they have the same beliefs. I mean, this is not – I think what I'm trying to do is to articulate in modern terms these old age basic principles. I mean, it's putting the old mysticism into the words of the street.
Hmm. That's an interesting way to put it. Okay, we have a caller. Good morning. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from.
Hi, is that me?
Oh, we can hardly hear you. Please get very close to your phone mic or your computer.
All right. All right. Is that any better?
A bit. A little closer.
Okay, well, I've got it right up to my ear. Let me try back on Skype.
Okay, you want to try on Skype. Yeah, I would recommend, folks, you call on Skype because regular phones do not work too well. So we'll do this, and I'll do that. So we were talking about the structure of your book, and you start out by defining terms. At what point do you bring science in? Because you actually do a radio show, I understand, where you talk about this stuff quite often with a whole range of people. What moved you from writing to radio? And how many decades was the radio show in preparation?
I've been doing the radio show for 3.5 years, and I would call it serendipity.
Okay.
It was not planned.
Well, tell us.
I was on a couple radio shows when my book came out, and the very first radio show, it was live. And I went to the studio, and the producer knew somebody, and they were looking for hosts. And I said, what the heck? It's sort of like, you know, doing something that I outside my comfort zone. And the producers have given me the opportunity to sort of go beyond the envelope. You know, the show's called Conversations Beyond Science and Religion. Mm-hmm. And so the same thing we're talking about now, trying to go beyond these set ways of thinking to sort of break down the barriers between science and religion, and also question some of these beliefs we've come up with. And so I've enjoyed it because I've not only had the opportunity to speak with so many intelligent people from all over the world, but also people that are all, you know, first-time authors that are trying to make a name for themselves, and professors, and you know, it's kept me not only up to date with a lot of these things, but I understand now, Richard, that I'm not alone in this quest to try.
Okay, I think we have our caller back. Are you on the air?
Yeah, Richard.
Yes?
Yeah, hi, Richard. Hi, Philip.
Hi there.
I love this show. I love this show because I love this kind of topic that you're doing tonight. And I wanted to run this past Philip just to get his impressions. About 25 years ago, I came across a concept that I had never considered before, and I found it to be kind of revolutionary. All right, think in terms of two realms. One is the realm of experience, and one is the realm of interpretation. And to illustrate it, you have a football game in a stadium. On the field, you have the players engaged in the experience of being in a football game. Meanwhile, up in the stands and on the sidelines, you have the cheerleaders, you have the fans yelling rah-rah or boo-hiss. Mm-hmm. You have the guys up in the press box interpreting what they're seeing happening down on the field. And there's more to that, and I know because time is short, I won't go into all of it. But, you know, the interpretation mindset is good, bad, up, down, positive, negative, you know, bad, evil, good, wonderful, you know, that type of thing.
Are we still talking about a football game?
Yeah, but on the field, you've got the people actually in the experience of being in a football game. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you get the distinction?
Yes. Yes.
One is observing a reality, the other is being in the reality.
Basically, yeah. And I had never really considered it, you know, the roles that the two different things play in life. You know, if you're actually experiencing an experience without interpretation, without putting values to it, that's one way of being. And another way of being is to be up in the stands or on the sidelines waving your pom-poms or up in the press box pontificating.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems an apt metaphor for at least America and probably the world.
Hmm. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
Anything else?
No, that was basically it. I was just kind of interested in hearing what Philip had to say about that and whether he had ever considered anything like that and, you know, and how it relates to life as we've become aware of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the way I would look at something like that is, and I think that's a really good metaphor, is it's something Richard alluded to before, which is the upper, the higher, and the lower, or the above and below.
As above, so below.
Yeah, I like the, to me, you think with the big mind and you act with the small mind. In other words, if you have the concerns of the global community or the in mind when you act, but you can only act through yourself, you can only have your own experiences, that's how we build a better world. And, you know, Kant said something like, you know, act as if your behavior was creating a universal law. The same thing, it's very similar to the golden rule, you know. And so that's the way I look at it. I think you've got to have both in mind, and that's mm-hmm. that's how you get power. Act, you know, think with the big mind, act with the small mind.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, using the analogy another step further, the guys on the field are being about intention. That is to say, they're in the game. They have something at stake. What they do or don't do matters.
Right.
Meanwhile, the people up in the stands or the cheerleaders or the guys in the press box, they're like the guy at the end of the bar, who the guy in the diner who knows everything. He has an opinion about everything, but nothing happens as a result of his opinions other than him having the opinions.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
That's a very interesting point of view, Scott. Very interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, thanks for letting me share that, because it's a pretty nifty thing when you play with it a little bit.
It's a good metaphor. It's got a lot of – it's a very rich metaphor.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Have a good morning.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me see. We only have about 10 minutes left. You're working on the second book. Obviously, you felt you hadn't said enough in the first book, and I'm really glad you learned to type faster. What's the second book about? What's the title? What's your working title?
The working title is "This Revolution Starts the Fire in the Mind," and the point it's the.
Well,
point,
but that's the title.
That's the title.
Got to be a shorter title. Come on. Okay. Movies have like one word titles. You got to have something that grabs people.
You're right. Right. It is a working title, but the point is I think we change the world by changing the mind, and this is sort of it's similar to what Scott was saying.
But whose mind? Your own. See, to me, when I meet a lot of people, I find the biggest problem to getting all the good stuff we want, a world of peace, a world that works, is people's self-limitations. People don't realize how powerful they are. That's part of what I want to do with Jimmy Carter, to demonstrate that collectively we can change the future and make it what we want if we want it bad enough and we're willing to associate with other like minds to achieve that objective.
You need to be one of my reviewers on my next book, because I'm only half joking, but but you just hit on something that is extremely important and that I completely agree with. That's also in both books, which is that you cannot limit yourself. That doubt is our biggest enemy. That it's that I can't do this. That is something we need to overcome, and that thought permeates everything. You know, whether it's I can never get a diploma, I can never get a job, I can never, you know, make money to, I can never be a better person, I can never rise from the ghetto, I can never write a book, I can never do a radio show. I mean, all these things. You have to eliminate the self, the self limiting thoughts. Otherwise, you can never do anything. I mean, I strongly believe that unless you believe you could do something, you can never do it.
Did you ever watch a TV show called Star Trek?
Of course, yes.
Do you remember one of the final episodes of the original Star Trek? Where they're in kind of they somehow find themselves in the OK Corral, and they're trying to get out of this alien manipulation, a scenario where they're, you know, supposed to fight the Clantons and all that. And at some point, Spock looks at what they've devised, and he says, by the laws of physics, this should work, and it doesn't work. Therefore, and then he realizes that their reality is completely being consciously controlled, and he does a mind meld on each of the main characters, on Kirk and on McCoy and whatever, Scotty, I guess, and he basically says, puts his hands up in the familiar, you know, mind meld position, and he looks at them and he says, they have to go into this deep belief system where the bullets are not real. The bullets will not touch me. The bullets are not real. And then there's this great scene at the end where, you know, the Clantons are firing their six guns and they're going right through and puncturing the fence. And it's the quintessential example from Gene's fertile mind of how consciousness can control reality.
Yeah, that's I think I do remember that. That's a classic. You know, when you were talking, it reminds me, you know, the people that go to these retreats and they learn how to walk on hot coals.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that is possible. And frankly, I don't know if I could control my mind enough to do that.
Well, the Newtonian explanation, the physical explanation, is that they're basically utilizing what's called the Leidenfrost effect. So the moisture in the bottoms of their feet, if they walk fast enough, the moisture is what is whisked away by the heat, and it protects them so they can reach the end of the hot coals and walk back on the grass. And it's similar to when I was a kid, 10 years old, I heard about this phenomenon that you could actually take a cardboard box, put water in it, and put it on the stove and turn on the burner, and it wouldn't burn.
Hmm.
And it doesn't until the water is all evaporated. And then, of course, it goes up in a ball of flame, and your mother comes in, and she's shrieking, and there's all kinds of nasty stuff that goes on. Well, I don't remember all that. That was very traumatic. But anyway, that's the Leidenfrost effect.
Well, I mean, but I think your point is a good one, which is that what I'm getting from is that we are moving from science fiction to science fact. You know, what was science fiction in Star Trek and presented in sort of a, you know, dramatic effect. We're moving to science fact, where we're starting to realize that these things are true. I mean, we're only, you know, scratching the surface of this notion that consciousness can really affect reality. But I think it's amazing that so much we're seeing actually happening that we used to think was fiction.
Okay, in the mind of in the area of consciousness, give us a couple of examples.
In the area of consciousness where
consciousness is actually affecting reality. I mean, I've given you a few examples of where I think I've seen it.
Well, I thought one of the most powerful things that intrigues me was Dean Radin's experiments with the random number generator,
mm-hmm.
where he has that generator that supposedly is programmed to just spew out random series of numbers,
just white noise,
right? And in terms of like world affecting events like the Academy Awards, the Super Bowl, and 9/11, all of a sudden there was order. There was more order in the random number generator, mm-hmm. as if these world events were affecting this machine.
Now, are you aware of one of the really amazing peculiarities about the measurements during 9/11 of the Princeton Egg experiment?
Go ahead.
They got effects 4 hours before the planes hit.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing.
So how do you explain that?
Yeah, well,
Come on, Philip. How do you explain that?
Well, just like I said before, doesn't it sound like a precognitive dream?
Of course. So how do you explain that, which is a subset of what this experiment showed, that there's a temporal dislocation as well as a physical dislocation?
Well, it's similar. It's related to synchronicity. How does a synchronicity occur? And, you know, how do random events all of a sudden operate in sequence, and you know, how do these coincidences occur? And I think that the one answer would be that there is a storyline in the one consciousness that is being played out, and it's sort of an intention that precedes the physical act.
See, one of the things that I'm concerned—
just made that up, but that's not bad.
Not bad at all.
That's my best guess.
Thank you. One of the things I'm concerned about is what's going on in Syria right now. We have the Russians. We have the Americans. We have F-16s flying past MiGs. We've got crowded skies. We've got bizarre things going on the ground. We've got Assad desperately trying to hang on to power. We've got ISIS, you know, taking over community after community. And it's really a mess. We've got 4 million people who are fleeing what's going on there. And I'm beginning to wonder if, in fact, like the 9/11 experiment where Dean was able to detect hours ahead of time the awful effects, the tremor in the force from what happened, are those millions of people fleeing that part of the Middle East leaving because at some level they're connecting with events that they do not want to be around when they unfold? And if that's what's going on, could we focus attention on that part of the world? Could we bring coherence and sanity and peace to a situation which is not amenable to any military, diplomatic, or other kind of initiative that we can conceive, because it's spiraling out of control, and the only thing that's left is some massive Maharishi intervention by the consciousness of people who get it, that we can, in fact, affect the future this way?
Well, I think I go back to the same thing. It's worth a try. It's worth the effort. I mean, how would we ever know if this kind of method would work unless you try it? And this is what I call scientific experimentation of an hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
The hypothesis is, can we affect this? Well, let's try and let's see what happens. So I think it's, you know, to me, as you were saying that, you know, so much of what we talk about as being these, you know, seemingly odd events, we know naturally are true. You know, something, you know, we have these descriptions for it. We say, well, something is in the air,
or in the ether,
or I had a bad feeling about this person.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like that was the right way to go. You know, we sense these things,
but we don't articulate them. And
the gut.
I have to articulate this sad fact. We're out of time.
Mm.
The show's ended.
Wow.
We'll have to have you back.
That was a blast.
Well, it was a blast for me too. I want to thank you, my guest this morning, Philip. Philip, you have been a wonderful guest. You've written an extraordinary book. Thank goodness it's not going to take 40 years for the next one to be published.
Yeah.
So until next time, tomorrow morning, same time, same bat channel, this is The Other Side of Midnight. And remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning.